your government doesn't feel you can be trusted with a powerful weapon, your thoughts. Encryption is a munition, and in the battle to keep your thoughts your own, it is your right to have military grade. This is Privacy Patriots, episode number 12, recorded, I'm sorry, episode 11.5. This one goes to 11.5. Recorded on July 22nd, 2018. The Patriots and its active members have received no legal instruments requiring us to turn over any information since our last podcast, dated May 20th, 2017. My name is Fong.
And I'm EJ. Welcome to the Privacy Patriots podcast, the official podcast of Restore the Fourth.
All right, so we're here at the HOPE Conference in New York City, as we do biannually. And actually, it was at HOPE that we birthed this thing we call Privacy Patriots, the voice of Restore the Fourth. You may remember Restore the Fourth as a bit of a grassroots movement that came in the wake of the Snowden revelations in 2013. That following July 4th, we had marches in many major cities in the country, but since then we've actually coalesced into our own nonprofit, 501c4, and we're still going after the lawmakers and putting our two cents in on Fourth Amendment cases on the judicial level. So with EJ and I here, we're glad to have a perfect guest for today, Theo Chino, who's our chapter lead for Restore the Fourth here in New York City.
Good morning.
And you've been a busy guy at this conference so far.
Absolutely.
I said, you know, we only have an hour. We have to keep things concise. So let me get Theo on the show.
Well, good luck.
He doesn't have a lot to say.
Well, I do encrypt and I do vote. And yeah. I can talk about encryption and voting at the same time.
Yeah.
And that will bring us into the blockchain.
By the way, if you're on site, we still have some of our famous I Encrypt and I Vote t-shirts available. We're giving them away with any $60 contribution to Restore the Fourth. But what's news here at the conference? I mean, here's, I think, where the minds get together. You kind of meet people who are kind of working on the next generation of tools and movements to protect privacy. Like, what are you guys hearing on the ground?
Well, what I picked up this year from this conference, this one, and I didn't go to all the technical talk. I went to the more political motivated talks. So what I gather from this conference today was that a lot of people are interested in participating in the democratic process, and they're talking a lot about voting and everything around voting. And what I'm trying to do is actually pushing not the voting but the running.
Mm-hmm.
So people go and run and explain to other people how easy it is to run for a position to which they can be voted in.
Yeah. And to jump off on that, you were talking to a gentleman yesterday who looks like he's running unopposed in his campaign. So he is to win.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so I discovered, I wanted to talk more about hacking.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to hack the Democratic Party.
Okay.
Because I am in New York. And
as well?
Because you're a political hack.
Exactly. I'm a total political hack. So I'm trying to get all the people I can to run. Because, I mean, it was interesting when I heard Chelsea yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And she ran. But she was against a machine that is mostly opaque.
Uh-huh.
And she said it. The machine didn't say they were going to run against me. But they were very much not doing anything. And by not doing anything, it was you were feeling all the force of the machine against
you.
And, we're not going to get involved. We're not going to make a meeting. So suddenly a debate between two candidates doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So her voice cannot be heard by those who carried that voice to the people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so just by not having that meeting and not getting involved, they're pushing her away and they're pushing her message away. Mm-hmm. And she said at a certain moment, you could see that it takes a tremendous force to go against the machine.
Yeah.
And hacking the Democratic Party is very simple. Take the bias laws of the Democratic Party where you live, read them, and it reads like source code. Mm-hmm. Source code. The meeting will take place on the 3rd July, the 3rd Friday of every month, or et cetera, et cetera. And you read the rule one by one. Mm-hmm. When is the election? We will elect our leader on the 5th meeting, on the 3rd week of the...
When there's a full moon and exactly. The stars align. Yeah.
And all those rules are written in plain English, but it does read like source code. Because you say, subsection 3.5, refer to paragraph 5.6. So you go, that's a go-to line.
Yeah.
Go to section 5.4.
Yeah.
And then it says, the election must be held in a hand ballot.
Yeah.
According to section 35-2, then go to there. And you realize, there is no 35-2. Bug.
And then you can use that.
And you use that, and that's what the loophole is.
Yeah.
Is all those little bug in the law. And if you read the bylaws correctly, and you use it as a computer code, you can hack it. And the first hack I did is run for county committee. New York is very is special in a way that every block where you live, there is a Democratic representative that represent about 600 voters.
Yeah.
And that's what that gentleman we met yesterday was running in Brooklyn,
yeah.
And he's running unopposed because nobody knows about them.
Yeah. And but to that point, New York is a wholly Democratic town, New York City, and so it would make sense that the Democratic Party is who you, Theo, would want to hack. But on the national level, when it comes to surveillance and privacy, we found that this is not really a partisan issue. A lot of people kind of expect that Democrats would kind of naturally fall on the side of privacy and lack of surveillance, but we've seen...
Where have you seen that? Did you see Cuomo yesterday? He's a Democrat.
Exactly. Yeah.
And he's pushing for camera face recognition on... He's literally pushing for the face recognition every time you go through a toll booth.
Yeah. And not only face recognition, this is like whole 3D model of your head recognition, so they can identify you from the back of your head when you turn your face as you drive through the tunnel. Jeez.
Exactly. And I mean, he's bragging about it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you're right, he's not a Democrat or Republican, but the Republican...
Because we've had Democrats that and Republicans that have been threats to privacy, and then we've had... both Republicans and Democrats in Congress that have, put forth bills to protect privacy.
Correct. And
an RRD does not give any indication of where you stand on this issue.
Well, that's why I was saying is the hacking part, because the same thing goes to the Republican Party in Arizona.
Yeah.
You can do the same hacking in the Republican Party in Arizona. Yeah. You just need to learn how to do it.
Mm.
And that's what I'm trying to do at the conference, is teach people, go hack your local political party.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm saying that, because for example in Hawaii, they seem to have the same system, a little bit like the New York system. And when they were pushing Bitcoin legislation over there, I reached out to my local me in Hawaii,
uh-huh.
And he showed up, and suddenly you could see the politician change the tune immediately when he said, I'm an elected Democratic county committee member, and I am against the legislation you're pushing.
Yeah.
And that's where the real, I discovered the at last hope that that's where the real power is.
Uh-huh.
And those meetings are like run, like actually, how's the show on NBC? Like America Got Talent?
Yeah.
That's much better organized than the way that political meeting takes place.
Okay. So it's a good time to note that Restore the Fourth, we are nonpartisan. And we have, I'd say I'm a progressive liberal but I'd say we have folks on the other side of the aisle, typically the libertarian persuasion. But like, this is definitely an issue where I'd say
there is no boundary.
Yeah,
there is
yeah.
no boundary. I mean, even the old people, the way I convince the old people in the club here I reminded of COINTELPRO.
Mm-hmm.
And I simply say, Cyrus Vance, when he was running for DA,
yeah,
I went in the club.
That's the Manhattan district attorney.
The Manhattan.
Very anti-encryption.
Who's terrible.
Yes, he's the one who wants. He's the one who's pushing the FBI to put the back door mm-hmm. into our cell phone. And I went to those club and I say, look at that man. You cannot endorse him because he's pushing COINTELPRO mm-hmm. with steroid.
Yeah.
And everybody goes, what do you mean? Well, now they don't even have to show up at the meeting. They can just turn your phone with the back door that he wants.
Yeah.
And everybody start looking at him and he started going red and like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
talk about that a little bit more here.
But you noted that you have been kind of going to politically oriented talks here at Hope.
Yes.
And although this is only my second Hope, you know, I imagine if we go back 20 years or so to when this started, this would be occupied, I'd say 99%, just by hackers and software developer types, whereas it has grown into this larger community that almost needs a new name. And if we have any brainstorm for that, because it's not just the hacker community here. When you come to Hope now, you're meeting journalists, you're meeting activists, you're meeting, you know, just privacy people, you know, who just value their privacy. They're not hackers. And I think it speaks to the fact that what, you know, us nerds are doing in the world is the scaffold for the new society that's forming. So it makes sense that, you know, the new issues of society are happening, you know, like the awareness of those issues are happening in this community here, in this building. You know, do you agree with that characterization? You have a good name for, like, what is this new community?
I would go further than that.
Yeah.
The community, the hacker community has existed online forever. Openness, transparency, sharing of information was the groundhold of our community online.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is, now that community is going public, and now the public is discovering, and the politician too, that we need to be open, transparent, sharing of information, and allow for privacy. So, is there another name? No. Well, I don't know, but
I mean, we can name it whatever we want, or come up with names, but I don't know if the name's entirely important, as it's, we're the citizenry, and we have these rights, and we have these opinions, and they need to be heard, and we need to find ways to make them heard. And as you're saying, you know, you show up at your local thing, you run for something, you get your voice heard, you amplify voices, and you start hacking the system from the ground up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you think about it, GitHub, it's a big political thing.
Yeah.
Should we put a semicolon here on line 54? And after a semicolon, should we have a space and a return?
No spaces after semicolons.
But that discussion, those kind of discussion is what takes place on GitHub between developer when they go, they develop. We decide if we put an if statement here. Do we decide when, if we have a male? We have an if statement that said the other side, if he's married, is a female. Those are little decisions that we make as programmer that are politically charged every time. So going into the real world is not that hard.
Yeah.
It's simpler than people imagine.
Well, what if we, you know, if we substitute, I said community, how about interest group? I think we are starting to form a specific interest group that's not getting their values represented in government. There's no one who's yet to really lose their shirt in Washington on privacy rights. Because, so how do we kind of build our niche even more? You know, like, I think a name is important because you talk about the LGBT movement or the gun rights movement. That's got, you know, like, it's got a nice digestible label, and up till now, the best you could say is, you know, the hacker community or the hacktivist movement. But it really is
a privacy movement.
Yeah,
it's a privacy movement. I don't think there is other name. I mean, we are for a privacy movement, but the Fourth Amendment is more than privacy.
Mm.
It's much more. So.
It's psychological security in your own thoughts and your own being. You don't have to watch what you are doing. You can be you.
Exactly.
I always describe it succinctly as just the right to be left alone until proven otherwise.
Well, there is a bill, I believe, in Nebraska that was called like that. There was one line, right to be left alone.
Yeah.
Article 1, right to be left alone.
Yeah.
And
period. Full stop.
And that was it. And I forgot what state, but yes. And I think it's an important thing, but how do you describe it to politicians, what it means, and how do you implement it?
Well, I remember that 2 years ago, I met you here.
Yeah, exactly.
We were in the FOIA workshop, and I remember it was like I got to witness the birth of Theo Chino, the privacy advocate, because like I could literally see the light bulb on top of your head. You came out of that like, we've got to do something. We've got to make things happen here. What are we going to do? And then you did it. Like the next 2 years, I followed you from afar. I'm up in Albany. You're down here in New York. But like Theo Chino, you're here. You're there. You're getting in Cyrus Vance's face like... You made it happen over the next 2 years, and you continue to. So, like, tell me about that experience. Like, how did you go from that light bulb over your head to where you are right now?
Well, the light bulb moment, as you saw, was when Aesthetic put us in a challenge. Remember, he was doing his Oakland privacy thing?
Yeah.
Mm. And he says, what are you guys doing in New York? And I'm like, yeah, well, we're not doing much here.
Mm-hmm.
we're good point.
Yeah.
And I discovered privacy through Bitcoin. So it was in 2013, I discovered Bitcoin, and I'm like, that's super cool technology. I went into my little hole, left alone, and about 6 months later, they decided to regulate Bitcoin. And I'm like, hold on, time out, stop. And I started fighting against the New York banking regulator, NYDFS.
Yeah, they wanted you to get a BIT license, right?
Correct. They wanted to make the BIT license.
Was there some repeal of that recently? Or
not at all.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Well,
some guy, we can talk about it later on that one. But how to go from, you discover what it means to be a Bitcoiner and the implication of being a Bitcoiner. And then you say, wait a minute, your regulation is illegal. You are not, first of all, you don't have the right to regulate because you didn't do it right. But New York City is full of loopholes. And he used one of those loopholes to get it through, and I used the second loophole to try to stop him. And anytime you go into a legal matter, it takes time, so you have to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
So we are 3 years, I lost the case, we're in appeal, and we have to wait until September or 2019.
Knock on wood.
Knock on wood, thank you.
Now, something interesting happened in New York City recently in that the city council created a new position of a privacy officer. And
I wanted to get to that. You're right.
Yeah.
They changed the charter of the city of New York.
Yeah.
So ingrained in the DNA of the city of New York, there is a chief privacy officer that is where the task of that person is defined in the charter. So that is huge because the mayor or a politician cannot just go around and change those little rules like, oh yeah, you can do more or you cannot. What the job of that person is in the DNA of New York City now.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did when Aesthetic, and it was not me alone. I mean, there was a lot of people behind the scene that worked tirelessly to get each step forward.
Yeah.
And Cyrus Vance, when you realize what Bitcoin is and what it is, you realize what privacy is.
Yeah.
And then from there, you realize it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize why it's important. The right to have the whistleblower, because whether you like Julian Assange or not, they got him through the credit cards.
Yeah.
Like, we know that.
The power of the purse.
The power of the purse.
Yeah.
And this is what the regulator want to do. They want to regulate everybody's purse so they can hold you. If you don't sing what they want you to sing, they'll say, well, we'll make you stop.
Yeah. Mm. So who got named as the New York City privacy officer?
So her name is Laura Negron.
Uh-huh.
We haven't met her yet. We're meeting her, well, by the time if you hear this podcast after Friday, the 27th of June or July, we will have met her. But we're meeting her on next Friday for the first time. We're going to have a meet and greet, and we're going to figure out where she stands on many issues. And to get back to the light bulb we had here, Richard Stallman was instrumental to give me three little rules.
Okay.
And those rules allowed me to explain to the politician what that a collection should be to keep something private.
Okay, and what are those rules?
Oh, I just read them to Richard upstairs.
It doesn't involve free hugs, does it?
No, it does not involve free hugs. But when you read those rules, they're so simple.
Yeah.
And Richard told us, when you frame the collection of data, you need to figure out what data must be collected for some important civic reason.
Yeah.
And should be published.
Yeah.
The second thing is the data that must be collected for some important civic reason, but should not be published.
Okay.
Open data, the open data movement.
Sure. Hmm.
And data that should not be collected at all.
Okay. So like we want to put things into three slots like that.
Exactly.
And would you say that's going to kind of be your agenda for that meeting on Friday?
We're going to talk about that, exactly, because that helped. I hope that will give her something to think about over spare time when she's trying to go over, because right now she's going over the first iteration of what report she must make and all that. So she's learning the rope of what do I need, what the charter tells me that I need to do. So we'll see.
Let's take a moment and let's go around the table, and maybe we'll start with you, EJ, like a talk that was really pivotal for you here in terms of privacy rights or surveillance.
There were a couple, but I think I would go with last night. I went to a talk titled, "And This Is It, What Went Wrong with Surveillance Reform After Snowden," which was a panel discussion led by some people, including the chairman of Restore the Fourth was on it, Alex Mathers, and some other people. And they were talking about basically how we have failed since the Snowden revelations, because that was a golden moment that really should have been an easy, wide sweeping victory, and was not for many reasons. And they really talked about how there are patriots and pariahs on both sides
of the aisle.
And that they were talking about, you know, how various pushes have sort of fallen apart, and how in the effort to get privacy reform, there has been sort of a wide group of people trying to sort of like meet them halfway, which is one tactic, but it shouldn't be our job to come to them and be like, well, is this tame enough for you? Does this give you the power you still want, but we get a little something? No, we should be like, no. This is what we want. Come to us. Give us a deal.
It's almost like, guilty versus proven innocent.
Yeah.
Why should I have to come to you and kind of help you? Like, this should be our default position, is one of privacy.
And then the other thing on there was somebody from, I believe it was, I forget.
Demand Progress?
Yeah, Demand Progress, I believe. Two things. He told the story of out in California, there was a state senator who was sort of making a lot of anti-net neutrality noise. Mm-hmm. And people were like, hey, we really support net neutrality. Would you, like, please change your opinion? And he was like, nah. And like, hey, we're your voters. Change your damn opinion. And they're like, nah. And then somebody threatened that, hey, we're going to put up a billboard in your district that says you don't believe in net neutrality. And all of a sudden, his tune changed real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this like rule of, you know, first you ask nicely, and then you ask a little bit more forcefully, and then you start doing things about it.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk to some of the Fight for the Future people, and there's a couple other organizations about, you know, maybe we start putting up billboards that say, you know, so-and-so wants the government to see your dick pics. And, you know, just something really inflammatory, and you put it out there, and then they have to defend the fact that they want that power.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we kind of have to start putting them on edge. Like, instead of us having to do damage control, make them have to do damage control. Yeah,
exactly.
Make it a third rail issue for them. So, you know, like, the underline, I did come away from that part of it, was billboard, because you know, at Restore the Fourth, I'm on the board, the national board, and, you know, especially now, because we were lucky enough to get kind of in a good position after a fundraising fundraising push offered by DuckDuckGo. So, like, we might have the ability to kind of put up billboards in certain districts and things like that. You know, now it's a matter of researching where and who.
Many years ago, shortly after I turned 18, a longtime friend of the family, who may or may not have been a member of the Socialist Party of America at some point, and there's old jokes about that, but they told me to, in a twist on the famous phrase, to be the trouble I wanted to see in the world, and I took that a little too much to heart, I think. So,
the thing that really stuck with me about that talk was the question of, I forget which panel speaker, I think it was Sean, brought up the question of, like, how did, you know, we got lots of support and great momentum from the masses for the SOPA-PIPA fight. We have it for net neutrality, but, like, it's fallen kind of flat for surveillance. And, you know, I think Alex and I really differ on this greatly. I really contend on my theory that it comes down to stuff. If you threaten Americans, at least, I'm not going to say people, but in America, if you threaten people's stuff, you threaten to take away their stuff, then they you know, go nuts. And with SOPA and PIPA and with net neutrality, there's at least the somewhat of a context of, like, you're not going to be able to play Netflix. You're not going to be able to use Reddit as you know it. And I think people really respond to that, whereas the NSA listening to your stuff, to what you're saying, you still get to keep all your stuff, which reminds me of a saying by Rachel Maddow, which is, I forget the what do you call it when you have a fiefdom and lords and peasants.
Feudal society.
Yeah,
there you go.
Feudalism with cable.
Yeah.
So you have this oppressive dystopia, but just with all the creature comforts of the previously free country. So, you know, I contend that that's, we have to kind of contrive, like, how this is going to affect people directly, you know, and make it less of a theoretical to kind of get people on board. I don't really have that brainstorm yet, but, like, getting, you know, I see any room, any time we get three heads like this together is an opportunity to brainstorm on that. How do you guys think we can kind of energize that kind of motivation of, like...
Well, what I was going to say is, if you remember the testimony that Restore the Force gave during the POST Act here in New York City, where one of the lawmakers came up and is like, they're starting fighting with the NYPD, and the NYPD was like telling the lawmaker, this is something you don't get. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, I think you, is what you're not getting is that I don't want my stuff to be on the internet.
Yeah.
And as a lawmaker, if you want, if we give you what you have, you will be able, everybody will be able to put what I have on the internet, and I don't want that. And suddenly that talk of privacy from that lawmaker, he gets it.
Yeah.
But there is no follow through. Because to have the follow through for the politician, he needs to have the grassroots movement behind him, knowing that there is a third rail. Mm-hmm. And so you hear them talking a lot. But if you don't put that third rail there, there is no energy for them to either grab it or get burned on it.
Yeah, the pressure from below needs to be greater than the pressure from above.
Yeah. And the NYPD has a great grassroots movement.
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, no, it's called the union.
Exactly, the union.
It's called the paramilitary force.
Oh, no, yeah, there is the paramilitary force, but there is the union. And that union is so literally, they say, if you pass the POST Act, we are going to run candidate against you. This is the NYPD union saying that to the lawmaker.
So, yeah.
And we need to be on the other side. And like you said, we need that grassroots move.
Yeah.
We need to galvanize them. And the issue you were talking is hard.
To kind of continue the circle, I wanted to note the talk that moved me the most was Barrett Brown. And, you know, we had talked about the Barrett Brown case on this show a bit, but, you know, I had only really read his story and hadn't kind of interacted with what he did on any level greater than that. And in fact, like, you know, I'd seen pictures of him, and I think up till now I thought he was British for some reason, but he's the he's this Texas Marxist, and like, I don't know, I can't help but say he's like cut from the same cloth as like a Bill Hicks or a Hunter S. Thompson, like this real gonzo type journalist.
I think the Hunter S. Thompson is a fairly appropriate comparison.
Yeah. So I mean, like, in short, if you're not familiar, like, he effectively embedded. He was a journalist that embedded with Anonymous during some of their activities and hacks, and
specifically against pseudo state sponsored surveillance apparatus.
That was a contractor, right?
Yeah, Stratford. Like Stratford and H.G. Gary, I think, was the other one, which are these like companies that basically rent out state level surveillance apparatus to other people who are willing to pay, you know, $50 million.
Yeah.
Like the Amazon.
But I mean, it's one thing to be a
Amazon recognition, their image recognition technology that they're selling off to the Border Patrol and police.
But it's one thing to be like a progressive muckraker here in the Northeast, but there's something just so stubborn and like headstrong about a Texas liberal kind of doing this stuff. Like blue fly in the tomato soup, right? they call it like.
Sure. No,
I don't know. I mean, in Texas, they seem to be a lot. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
Don't mess with Texas. They tell it to you.
Yeah.
They're pretty upfront about that.
Yeah. Another case in point. It can kind of just go either way with this issue.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the mentality and the sort of cross spectrum. Nature of this, that, you know.
Yeah.
He encompassed everybody.
Yeah. But it almost like, it was one of those moments, this talk, where like being at this conference and just being together with like such like minds for three solid days, like you see this guy and you're just like, why can't more people like this be in control of things? Like, what?
They have to hack the system first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Theo, what was your favorite talk?
Well, my favorite one. Oh, I have to say I was the Chelsea Manning. I was pretty much at awe by her emotion to try to go into the political process.
Mm.
And that, I mean, we see the novice that is going out from jail, no interaction, and suddenly trying to bring change. And he broke my heart to know that the machine is so heavy and she suddenly got crushed by it without realizing it.
Yeah.
And that's the second time she's getting crushed. Yeah. Or technically the third time she's getting crushed. And now she has a bullhorn so strong, but at the same time, no politician will approach her because she's kryptonite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we don't support her, like all the privacy activists that we are, and don't support her, no politician will ever talk to her. Yeah. She will always be the pariah. And she has such a strong message to give and such a natural one, but there is no one. She's alone carrying in the torch.
Mm-hmm.
And that broke my heart. And that's, for me, you know, I'm a sub guy, so. So I like those kind of moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on this show, we typically do a lot of news review. You know, in the time we have, we probably can't be as comprehensive as we usually are.
Or so rambling.
But, I did want to at least bring up some good news in the last 2 weeks. Which we've been bragging about, Restore the Fourth, which is the Supreme Court ruling on Carpenter versus USA, which Restore the Fourth had a bit of a part in, because our volunteer legal team, we try to submit amicus briefs to any major Fourth Amendment case, and which is kind of like, you, in legal terms, you are acting as a friend of the court, and you're submitting kind of a third party opinion to kind of add to the deliberations of a case. And, you know, we kind of made the point that, you know, this case involved cell phone location data, and we kind of made the point that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy in this case. And to speak to that a little more, I actually got to talk to Alex Matthews about it. We'll have a bit more of this interview when you hear the podcast version of this show, but here's a little bit of that interview I had with Alex about Carpenter versus USA. So I'm happy to be joined today by Alex Matthews. We're both here at the HOPE Conference in New York City. Alex, you're our national chair, Restore the Fourth. And we had an interesting Fourth Amendment case that came up before the Supreme Court about 2 weeks ago, I believe. This was
in the third week of June. This was the Carpenter case, and we knew it was going to be a blockbuster from the beginning because it was the first time since 1979 that the Supreme Court had squarely confronted the question of whether metadata associated with phones should require a warrant before law enforcement could access it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think for people to kind of grasp onto these cases, they almost like a story, and obviously every case has a backstory beyond just the metadata and the process. This was a case, my understanding was somebody who participated in a number of robberies of Radio Shack stores, is that right?
Yes. Ironically, he was in part stealing cell phones.
Okay. So, and to be clear, the question in Carpenter versus USA was they used cell phone tower location data to narrow this guy down, right? But they obtained that without a warrant?
They obtained it without a warrant, covering well over 100 days of his movements. And they used the locations of the cell phone towers to not exactly pinpoint his movements, but to give an accurate enough impression that it placed him near the location of four of the nine robberies.
Yeah, we would call that coarse location data, but it's getting better every day. They're getting better with that triangulating.
That's right. And
between
how
towers.
Coarse the location data is depends largely on whether you're in an urban or a rural area. In urban areas, the cell towers tend to be very closely spaced, and you can pinpoint somebody's location much more precisely than in a more rural area where it might be an area covering several square miles.
That makes sense. I mean, to really narrow down this picture for people, basically, as you're moving about with a cell phone, your device is kind of handshaking with any cell tower that it comes within range of, and it might handshake with a couple that are nearby, and if you have at least three that it talked to, then they could effectively triangulate where you were at that given time.
That's right. And so in the closing argument for the prosecution in the Carpenter case, they relied heavily on the cell phone tower data in making the argument that Carpenter should be convicted, and he was. But the Supreme Court overturned his conviction in a 5-4 decision. Ruling that the government needed to get a warrant for the historical cell site location information.
So they literally used his cell phone to catch a cell phone thief.
Yes.
Yeah. So If a warrant was not obtained to get this information, logistically, do we know how they obtained it? Obviously, it had to be through the carrier.
Yes, so they went to the carrier and they submitted an information request under something called the Stored Communications Act, which is 1980s era legislation that is very broadly used at present to obtain this kind of data. So what they were doing was normal law enforcement practice currently in the United States, and the Supreme Court said that that normal practice was not okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you know a bit more about the Stott Act and like what it argued or provided?
Essentially, it allows for an order for this kind of third-party communications data, which does not require a finding of probable cause, which is the language of the Fourth Amendment. It requires a lower standard that it is relevant to an ongoing investigation. Okay. So that's a much looser standard and is very easy to satisfy.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty. So, we'll have that full interview. If you check out our podcast in the next 24 hours, we should have that up. But just a little bit more about Carpenter versus USA. Kind of the two big legal principles that were involved there, where you are trying to track down this criminal and you effectively get their a log of their location by seeing what cell phone towers they connected to when. Whether that is protected by the Fourth Amendment Act, it kind of hinged on two precedents in past Fourth Amendment legal history, which was the Stott Act and what we call the third party doctrine, which
is bullshit.
Yeah. I say, you get a warrant for all the things. Like, why do we have to have this like pastiche of like, okay, well, you can get this outright, you can get this with a subpoena, and then you need a warrant for this. Like, just, I feel like anybody's digital data, but like what the third party doctrine kind of says is you should have no expectation of privacy when you hand over your data to another, a third party. So let's say they would argue that you're handing over your location data to the cell phone company by handshaking with their tower, and I think in the one dissent that was in the case, they kind of went on property basis of property rights, where they said like, well, this data is the property of the cell phone company, like their systems are generating it, and it's not and it's just happenstance. Which I can't jive with, but
it's also a problem of user interface. It's the explicit versus implicit sort of agreement. Like when I use a cell phone, I'm not explicitly giving the cell phone tower my location.
Yeah.
They are implicitly getting that data because I have to connect to their towers, and there are multiple towers around me. And by math, you know, you have three towers. You can figure out where somebody is by drawing circles and finding where all three intersect.
Yeah.
So I'm not explicitly giving them that content. And that's a user interface problem, which is a whole separate issue from third-party doctrine and all this.
But. Yeah. But then the Stott Act, as Alex explained, was about... It had to do with old mafia cases and someone wearing a wire. And I guess someone at some point made the argument that they had an expectation of privacy from that wire. I guess it was the early days of electronic eavesdropping, getting its first legal test. But yeah, so for more on that, check out privacypatriots.org we're PRIV. Just
Google Privacy Patriots.
Yeah, yeah.
We're the podcast one.
Yep.
I can't spell either.
So we do something every episode where we pick it's a special segment we do called Patriots and Pariahs. So we pick one patriot and one pariah, one person who has done something great in defense of privacy rights, and somebody who has presented themselves as a threat to privacy rights. So, starting with our patriot, this episode that goes to Tiana Smalls, who's a woman who was she was riding on a Greyhound bus. On June 7th, she was riding from Bakersfield, California to Las Vegas. As the bus approached a checkpoint at the Nevada state line, Ms. Small said the driver made an unusual announcement. Quote, "We are getting boarded by Border Patrol. Please prepare to show your documentation upon request." Ms. Small immediately reacted. According to the description she posted on Facebook, she stood up loudly and said, quote, "This is a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights. You don't have to show them shit." Unquote. She then used Google Translate to repeat her message in Spanish. Merde. reassuring the Spanish-speaking woman sitting beside her and probably countless other fellow passengers. Border Patrol agents boarded the bus and started to ask the passengers for their, quote, documentation. Ms. Small stood up and again shouted, "You have no right to ask me for anything. This is harassment and racial profiling. We are not within 100 miles of the border, so these agents have no legal right or jurisdiction here." Ms. Small's simple and courageous act of resistance was enough. The Border Patrol agents, realizing that they would face an uphill battle, immediately retreated, telling the driver to continue on.
Bravo.
Bravo. That's great. It's uplifting.
So, Theo, I have somebody in mind for the pariah, but I know you've already got new people you're mad at. So, like, if you want to pick somebody, we'll go with your choice. No? Okay.
Not this week.
You're feeling nice?
My plate is full for this week.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Let's go with Cuomo. I mean, hell.
Yeah.
I mean, Governor Cuomo.
Yeah. Reiterate that for us.
Is pushing.
Andrew Cuomo, our great governor here in New York.
Is pushing for facial recognition of a toll booth or anywhere. Actually, they took away the toll booth. And so they're the electronic toll booth. And now they want to facially recognize whoever goes through the toll booth.
Yeah.
And tunnels and bridges and...
And highways. And
highways.
Anything that has a toll booth.
Mm-hmm.
A virtual one now. He gets the prayer of the week. And we don't do politics here, so...
Well, you know, he is trying to sort of position himself as the sort of left liberal candidate, you know, and opposition to other forces, so to speak. And then he has this opinion that, you know, we should have this wide pervasive surveillance. And he was on record in the announcement of this bragging about the fact that, like, you know, if somebody turns their head to the side to avoid these cameras, you can identify them by their ear. Like,
And it's true, but...
It's true.
And it's a reality.
And it's scary, and it is not in any way progressive or forward-thinking policy to have.
So I hear there is other candidate running for the same slot, so pick another one.
Yeah.
I hear there is great woman nowadays running.
Yeah.
I think we have a couple more minutes, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. No, I was going to say, with that, to Tiana Smalls, thank you.
Yes.
And to Governor Cuomo.
Fuck you.
Redacted.
Oh, I'm sorry, we cannot...
No, we're in New York City. I think profanity is allowed.
Oh, yeah. Fuck you.
I mean, is the FCC listening? Yeah.
Yeah, so... I don't know. Where do you guys think you are going to head from here? Like, you know, I find these conferences very rejuvenating, kind of your mojo, your activist mojo. Like,
catch up on all that sleep debt you incurred.
What's next for... We'll start with you, Theo. What do you got planned once you get out of here?
From the booth?
No, from the comp.
Oh, the comp bed?
Yeah. No, I mean in the next year, you know.
In the next year?
And when you go back out into the world, having, you know, kind of recharge your Well, the motivation here at Hope.
So the abolition of the bid license will be something going on for me. Also getting more activists for Restore the Fourth here in New York, because there is a lot of people here in New York and we need to reach out to them, and they need to know that if they send us an email, we do respond, say hello, and at least we'll get from there.
Yeah. Do you have any inspirations, EJ, that you've come away with?
Yeah, I have a... There's a couple projects I'm sort of working on up in the Albany area. There's a thing with the... they swapped out the parking meters, and they're now collecting more data without offering any different functionality. You know, they're now all of the parking meters in downtown Albany ask for your license plate number, but they don't do anything with it, seemingly. And so to follow that rule of you ask nicely, then you ask a little more firmly, and then you do something about it, I sent an email asking nicely, like, hey, you know, I noticed this change. Can you provide a little bit more information, which they kindly ignored. So I'll ask a little bit more, and then I'll probably send a FOIA request, which is the Freedom of Information Act, which is a powerful, powerful tool for anybody who wants to know what their government is doing. Mm. And then other than that, probably talk to some people about billboards.
Tree billboard in Albany.
Yeah. Which is
tree billboard on each entrance of Albany.
So something I've been meaning to catch up on is, you know, in Albany, New York, we recently deployed body cameras on the police, which, you know, on the onset, I think everybody was kind of excited about, because of, you know, there is always that potential for accountability when the officers are wearing these. You know, it can kind of go both ways, but I initially saw it as one of those cases where, you know, I want to see more cameras on our officials and less on our citizens. You know, out of the two, I'll take that. But as you know, they're accounting citizens, and I'm on a community policing board up there, and as we started kind of digging into it, it gets very complex, you know, forming the policy of like how the camera is going to be used. But the scary part to me that I want to chase after now is in terms of the vendors of these cameras. Axon is the vendor that we used, formerly known as the Taser Corporation. So they're providing the cameras that the officers wear, but also the back-end systems that store the footage. And just this week, you know, I had been already bringing this up preemptively because, you know, we've seen, but the question of biometrics kind of came to a head in the last couple of weeks. You know, I had been already talking about it, and they said, you know, people were telling me, you're finding problems where they aren't. But
also, my understanding was that in the initial contract, they said that they were not collecting it, and they had no plans to collect, like, biometrics.
So number one thing I want to do is, you know, I want to try to get with APD and examine these contracts, especially because there were some questions even before last week's development in terms of what the contract said about whose intellectual property the footage belonged to. So I want to see that. But if the most recent thing I'm referring to is that Axon put forth a patent for a system that would not only have biometric facial recognition off of officer body worn cameras, but it would in real time query databases and cross reference for warrants and things like that. And I think is our worst-case scenario in terms of being in a perpetual lineup, or this kind of database dragnet, just like the toll booths. Mm. But, you know, like I'm trying to explain this to other members of my community board who are much older and not, you know, as versed in how this all works. And I think I want to break it down into three tiers, because one thing I discovered, like, not all facial recognition is alike.
Some of it is racist.
Well, yeah, there's that problem too. But I mean, like, there's three tiers, I would say. There's, you know, facial recognition of, like, this is a person's face with eyes and ears, all the way up to, you're almost making an intelligent bookmark on the footage so you can help find it. You know, you're not identifying anybody, you're not hitting any database. That would be, to me, tier one. Tier two would be, we have this footage, we think a serious crime has been committed, so we want to manually do a database search, but that's targeted. That would be tier two to me. What they're describing here is tier three, and that's scary, because that's total Big Brother, and I hope to make sure that that doesn't come to my town.
So I just had my light bulb moment listening to you, actually, right now.
Yeah.
And we should go talk to the Free Software Foundation. And right. I'll explain that to you in person. Thank you for that light bulb moment.
Wow. All right. And with that, I think we're almost out of time. So
yeah, they're coming for us with the curved hook,
come on,
I think.
Bring the, well.
So this has been episode 11.5. This one goes to, hang on, I forget my script unlocked. Jesus.
So this was a co-production between Radio Statler.
This has been episode 11.5 of Privacy Patriots, the official podcast of Restore the Fourth. Thanks for listening. And we hope to have you join us for our next episode.
And a big shout out to Radio Statler for hosting us here at the Hope Convention.
Oh, these guys are awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Head over to www.privacypatriots.org. where you can get further connected with us on Reddit, Twitter, and Facebook. And remember, keep watching the Watchers and stay tuned as we give you the information you need to keep your information your own.